From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Those researchers on board the ship trapped in the Antarctic ice spent today building a helicopter landing pad next to the boat in advance of a proposed helicopter rescue. 74 scientists, tourists, and crew have been stuck since Christmas Eve. Icebreakers have failed to reach them. Henry Fountain is science writer for The New York Times. Henry, what's the latest?
They're waiting for the weather to clear up so that the helicopter can take to the skies and rescue these people.
Well, we know that the weather's bad because it's hard to reach them. They'd been speaking to people on Skype, but that's been tough today because of the weather, although they have been tweeting. One tweeted Happy New Year because they've already gone through the New Year there.
Right.
How risky is this helicopter proposal?
I don't think it's any more risky than any kind of helicopter operation in polar regions, which, you know, carry more risk than in temperate climates. But this is a Chinese icebreaker. It's a Chinese helicopter. They're on a long voyage of their own in the Antarctic, so presumably they know what they're doing.
So the helicopter is launching off the icebreaker.
It is, and it's going to go, I guess, about 10 miles to the stranded ship, pick up 12 passengers at a time, and bring them back, and then the passengers will be taken by barge over to the Australian icebreaker, which is also on the scene, and the Australian icebreaker will take them to an Australian Antarctic station about 1,000 miles away.
Yeah. And, of course, the icebreaker couldn't get to them because of the thickness of the ice. We understand from a spokesperson for the expedition, Alvin Stone, who spoke to the Today Show, there's no plan C after this.
No, really. I mean, they don't. I think the plan C is just to wait it out. And in fact, that's what the crew, that's 22 members of the crew of the ship, are going to stay behind. And they'll basically be waiting it out. You know, the ice is, it's summertime in the Antarctic, so it's not like the entire sea is going to freeze over.
A couple questions. When you say it's warmer, it looks pretty cold to me.
It is pretty cold, but it's not as cold as winter when it's, I don't know how cold it is.
80 below, right.
Yeah.
Well, and we're told they have food for 2 weeks, dried goods for 2 weeks after that, so they got 4 weeks. So it's not as if there's some tragedy in the offing.
No, it's not like, you know, Robert Falcon Scott at the South Pole or anything like that. It's not a life or death situation at this point.
Unless, of course, one of them gets very ill and that helicopter can't get in. But remind us, what was the expedition doing?
They were retracing the steps, more or less, of a very famous Antarctic expedition led 100 years ago by a geologist by the name of Douglas Mawson, who was really the first person to explore that part of Antarctica, which is the part that's due south of Australia. And what they're trying to do is get a sense of how things have changed in 100 years, primarily due to climate change.
Well, there are also paying tourists on board, paying a lot to be on the ship. They are probably having the adventure of a lifetime. But there has been some criticism. It wasn't a completely necessary trip. It's not a life-saving trip. It's a research trip. And now this is a very expensive rescue.
It is, although, according to the law of the sea, whoever actually performs the rescue pays for the cost. So the ship itself and the crew and the passengers aren't really on the hook for anything.
I think that's the criticism.
Well, but countries want to be able to pay for a rescue because they never know when somebody from their own country may need some other country to come in and help them. So it's really not, I think that criticism is a little invalid.
Well, Henry, address another criticism, and it may be confusion about climate change. Fox News has written that here they were trying to prove that there has been global warming and they're locked in ice.
You know, that's not a valid criticism either. There's always pack ice in the Antarctic, and it's true, ice in the Arctic, in the North Pole, has been disappearing, but the ice situation in the Antarctic is totally different. In fact, pack ice has been increasing very slightly in the Antarctic over the last 10 or 20 years, and scientists think it's actually related to global warming in that it's changing wind circulation conditions that are keeping more ice in the region for longer.
Well, and we know that global warming doesn't necessarily mean warmth everywhere. It means extremes as well.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, so we're waiting for the helicopter rescue. But meanwhile, you mentioned that the trip's original purpose was to trace the path of the famous expedition of Douglas Mawson. He had a hard time.
He did. He went out on, it was a three-year expedition, and they did a lot of different things, explored a lot of areas. But he went out on a particular journey with two other people, and he was the only one who made it back alive. One of his colleagues fell down a crevasse and disappeared forever, and another one may have suffered from too much vitamin A, eating too much liver from slaughtered dogs, essentially, and went more or less crazy and fell into a coma and died. So it was not without its horrible events.
And at least for now, those tracing his path are not on that trajectory at all.
No, in fact, they've got plenty of food, and as one of the participants said, they're drinking a lot of gin and tonics, so I don't think they're suffering.
Henry Fountain, science writer for the New York Times, thanks so much.
Sure, thank you.
Well, tomorrow, the Boy Scouts of America will welcome openly gay scouts for the first time. In May, representatives of Boy Scout councils from across the country passed a measure by about 60% allowing openly gay youth in. The BSA still bans gay leaders. Some religious organizations which sponsor troops have broken ties with the scouts. A new Christian scouting organization, Trail Life USA, was organized after the vote. It will also officially launch tomorrow, and some families are leaving the BSA for the new group. But the Catholic and Mormon churches have held fast with their support. Pat Curry is Scout Executive and CEO of the Dallas-based Circle 10 Council. They're the regional organizing body for the Boy Scouts in Dallas and 12 nearby counties. So, Pat, what's the thinking where you are? What's the anticipation of this change?
Well, honestly, for us, it's business as usual.
Well, because when we've spoken of this big day tomorrow, a lot of people have said, well, I'm sure there are, gay scouts already participating. It's just that, nobody really talks about it. Is that part of your sense?
We don't really inquire about sexual orientation. That's not what scouting is all about. That's not who we are.
Mm-hmm.
Our message is all about getting as many kids as we can into the scouting program and impacting their lives in a positive way.
Well, we know the Boy Scouts of America has put together a list of responses to some frequently asked questions they're getting. For instance, can a scout march in uniform in a gay pride parade? And the answer is no, because every youth member is free as an individual to express his or her thoughts or take any action on political or social issues, but not while wearing a scout's official uniform and insignia when doing that. So perhaps that's something you're passing along. Another question is, how publicly active should a gay scout be? And the reply is, well, you can acknowledge your preference, but it can't reach a level of distraction, meaning handing out pamphlets or doing some sort of promotion or distributing information of a sexual nature. I would imagine that as a scout leader, you wouldn't want anyone to do that, no matter what their sexual preference.
Correct. All those policies in terms of using the scouting program to try to put forward any type of political agenda have been in place for years. That's why I say to us, it's just sort of business as usual. We have for long times not allowed the scouting program or the scout uniform, or for that matter, and certainly even more important, our individual scouts, to be used to put forward some particular agenda. There's really, to my knowledge, is no real change in any policies or procedures going forward, and I don't believe in a practical matter there will be either.
How do you personally feel about the change?
I recognize that people have different opinions about this policy, and for that matter, about many other things that we have policies on in scouting. But I think that, for me, it's all about that the scouting program makes a difference in kids' lives.
Well, obviously, you're still in scouting. You haven't left, for instance, to join this new alternative group, Trail Life USA, the Christian scouting organization. Does that mean that you support the policy change or feel that whether or not you do, you're going to go forward?
With any organization, particularly one as large as we are, with well over 2.5 million youth members and well over 1 million adult volunteers, there's going to be varying opinions on every topic, not just this topic, but on every topic. And so, again, I think the majority of what all of us should focus on is those things that we do agree on, which is that the scouting program is going to make a positive impact on the young people we serve.
And obviously that's very meaningful to you. But I'm just wondering, although the Boy Scouts of America think that there aren't really going to be big issues, there are questions about, for instance, sleeping arrangements or showering. These are some of the questions they're getting. And we understand the BSA is encouraging units like yours to have greater individual privacy anyway, to begin moving away from a tradition of group showers, for instance, and to allow the parent of a scout to make a request to not tent, for instance, with another scout, to honor those wishes. Is that something that you're already hearing about or anticipate having to do?
regardless of this particular policy, as you said, you're absolutely correct. Most Boy Scout councils have been for years moving away from the more traditional group showers and things like that. We have had to deal with making sure that privacy and things of that nature were taken care of long before this policy.
What about what some are saying is the inevitable next step? Former Defense Secretary Robert Gates is scheduled to take over the BSA as president next spring. Now, he, of course, helped change the military's Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy, which banned openly gay soldiers. And now there are gay rights groups hoping he's going to end the ban that still exists in the BSA against gay adult leaders. Would you be for allowing gay adult leaders, openly gay adult leaders?
The change to the membership policy for adult volunteers was not under consideration at any point during the debate of the resolution that was passed. And again, as a membership organization, I think that they have spoken.
Well, meanwhile, as you start the new year, are you seeing any impact from this ruling? We're reading about your colleagues over in Houston, Troop 55. They say membership has remained steady. Others are saying they've actually had an increase in membership since this decision by the BSA. Have you seen it either way, either damage or increase membership for your troops?
Honestly, it would be, I think, hard to make a judgment that
right.
X number left because of this issue or any other individual issue.
Pat Curry, Scout Executive and CEO of the Dallas-based Circle 10 Council for the Boy Scouts of America. On tomorrow's rule change, January 1st, openly gay young people will be allowed to join the Boy Scouts. Pat Curry, best of luck to you tomorrow.
Thank you, Robin. Appreciate your time today.
Okay. So what's your take on the Boy Scouts' new policies? Are you signing your child up because of it or maybe pulling them out? Are you a leader anticipating these changes? Weigh in at hereandnow.org, at facebook.com/hereandnowradio. On Twitter, I'm at hereandnowrobin. You're listening to At Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from GEICO, offering a variety of insurance products, including auto, renters, boat, and motorcycle. More at geico.com or 1-800-947-AUTO.
In 2005, the world's first face transplant was performed in France. It would be several years before the same surgery would be attempted here in the U.S. But thanks in large part to the efforts of one young Boston surgeon who fought to bring the difficult surgery to his hospital, patients here in Boston whose faces have been destroyed can get a new one and another chance. WBUR's Lynn Joliker from the Here and Now Contributor Network tells the story.
And give me a big smile now. Yeah, the left side is starting to pull.
I can tell, I can feel it different here when I smile,
The simple act of smiling, it's not so simple for Carmen Tarleton. But her plastic surgeon, Dr. Bodin Pomahawk, is happy to see it's getting easier. Tarleton's face is not the one she was born with.
And how is breathing through your nose?
I'm wondering if it's making me more tired, because sometimes I have to open my mouth to breathe.
In February, Dr. Pomahawk transplanted a face from a deceased donor in her 50s onto Tarleton, a 44-year-old former registered nurse and mother of two. That was 6 years after Tarleton's estranged husband beat her with a baseball bat and doused her with industrial-strength lye, dramatically disfiguring her and burning 80% of her body. It was the fifth face transplant Pomahawk performed at Boston's Brigham and Women's Hospital since 2009.
We take it for granted that you, in the morning, look briefly at your face and fix your hair or whatever, but you interact the entire day with other people and you're used to just normal reactions. These patients are used to these horrified looks and isolation. They can't eat outside, they drool, they can't smell. You kind of realize that the life without face is essentially social death.
At 42 years old, Pomahawk sports a graying goatee and glasses and reveals a gentle, modest demeanor. But his unassuming presence belies a fierce determination and focus. In 1996, one day after graduating from medical school in his native Czech Republic, Pomahawk packed up and flew to Boston, where he had previously spent a brief time during a medical exchange, but knew no one and had no work or schooling lined up.
One day, he just showed up without an appointment, and he offered to work for no pay, and I told him that was a bad idea.
That's Dr. Elof Erickson, the chief of plastic surgery at Brigham and Women's. So impressed by Pomahawk's determination, he hired him to work in a lab for a small salary. Pomahawk attributes his ambition to growing up in communist Czechoslovakia, where his father, a chemical engineer, was persecuted for signing a declaration against the Communist Party, and therefore could only find odd jobs outside his profession.
So he kept emphasizing to us, his sons, that we should learn language, that we should think beyond the Iron Curtain. So I was primed to just go out and explore.
And he got his chance. Just as he was starting medical school in 1989, the nonviolent Velvet Revolution happened. The communist leaders resigned, meaning the system that had been limiting him his whole life was gone, and he wanted to compete on the world stage. He knew he wanted to be a surgeon, but once he got into the surgical residency program in Boston, he knew plastic surgery was his calling because, he says, he could really be creative and innovative. And he quickly zeroed in on the face.
I think it's the most fascinating part of the human body that one can work on. And it's so intricate and so specialized, so unique. It's so hard to get it right, to do the reconstruction well. So I was all fired up about that.
He tried many operations to improve different parts of Carmen Tarleton's face in the years after she was attacked.
The ideas he had about certain surgeries to try and help me were creative, and even though they didn't all work, it was always worth the risk.
But the more times it didn't work with his burn and trauma patients, the more frustrated Pomahawk became.
Patients were often still looking very deformed, and many times the goals shifted from reconstruction to more wound control. My wife is a physician as well, so sometimes I was very happy about the result. I showed her the picture, and she was like, is this really it? Is that all you can do?
Ultimately, it wasn't all he could do. The world's first face transplant, a partial one, happened in France in 2005. And Pomahawk, still a junior doctor virtually unknown in medical circles, wanted to do the same thing in Boston. His mentor, Dr. Erickson, was one of his earliest champions. But there were others who needed convincing.
There were not only skeptics, there were naysayers. And I was trying to do my best to cheer him on and support him.
Through a long, painstaking process, Pomahawk addressed the ethical questions raised by the hospital's administrators and review board. How would patients be psychologically impacted by having someone else's face? Would a transplanted face transport some of the donor's identity along with it?
People were concerned that we may be creating essentially dead people walking again.
Pomahawk and his colleagues worked up computer simulations to dispel that worry. But they also had to address whether it was worth it to subject patients to risky, lifelong immune suppression drugs for an operation that wasn't life-saving. And the fact that Pomahawk would have to retrieve a deceased donor's face before the vital organs were removed for donation, so the face would receive blood flow. In 2009, all the work paid off. Pomahawk led a team of surgeons on a partial face transplant for a man who had fallen on the electrified third rail in a subway station. They followed 2 years later with the country's first full face transplant, and they've done three since, making Brigham and Women's Hospital the leading face transplant center in the U.S.
We'll figure out whether there's anything to do with the eyelids, but if there's not much, we'll start insetting, you know, mental nerves, oral mucosa.
The video from Carmen Tarleton's 16-hour face transplant shows Dr. Pomahawk's calm, deliberate, and humble manner. Though he is in charge of the surgery, he frequently takes a step back for a colleague to lead a portion of it. He works with a team of extremely skilled surgeons, he points out. They delicately connect dozens of arteries, veins, nerves, soft tissue, and muscles.
Now we'll probably carve out from the nose the septum.
Pomahawk spends about 80% of his work time in the operating room or in clinic visiting patients. The other 60% is spent on research. You'll notice, he jokes, that that adds up to 140%. Among his many research projects, he's working on ways to help the body build permanent tolerance for transplanted tissues, ultimately eliminating the need for lifelong immune suppression drugs.
Then I see that not only face, but variety of sort of a body of restoring operations will be feasible, and that's really what will scale it up from few individuals with the most tragic injuries to technology that can help thousands of, perhaps hundreds of thousands of patients.
Soon, his hospital will start doing leg transplants. He'll play a role, but his focus will remain on the face. Several more candidates are waiting for donors, and he's closely monitoring the progress of the five who've already received new faces.
But you feel well?
I do. I feel better and better.
Good.
Yeah. And I'm learning to play banjo. So one of these days,
wow,
I'll play you a banjo song.
Pomahawk calls them his patients for life.
Well, they all have my cell phone. They all have direct access to me at any time. I'm almost like their personal doctor. Whatever problem they have, they can, and they do, go directly to me.
He says he feels responsible for their success and any setbacks. And though their new faces didn't save their lives, he's thrilled they have gotten their lives back. For Here and Now, I'm Lynn Joliker.
And we have a quick heads up about tomorrow's program. We're going to meet two chaplains who tend to a most unique flock, travelers. Perhaps someone traveling for surgery like the one we just heard about. That's tomorrow. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Gentle Giant Moving Company, coordinating moves in neighborhoods across the country with locations nationwide. More at gentlegiant.com. And Nuance, with Dragon speech recognition software for business professionals to create documents, emails, and manage schedules by speaking. Nuance.com.
You know the list of resolutions. They involve weight, maybe drinking. Well, what about a New Year's resolution about money? Michelle Singletary is the nationally syndicated personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. She's got an idea, a 21-day financial fast. She joins us from the studios of NPR in Washington. Michelle, no spending at all?
Not at all, except for the things that are necessities. And that list is a lot shorter than you think.
Like what?
Well, I mean, groceries, medicine, things like that. But you can't go shopping, can't get your hair done, no movies, no eating out, all that kind of stuff.
You say don't even go into a mall. Don't window shop.
That's right. You know, when that's like temptation. I call the mall the den of iniquity because you go in there and you can't resist all the sinful temptation to spend with money that you don't have.
Okay, so fast for 21 days, except if you need things for the children, you know, food and necessities and things like that. And you know what? I do this. I love this. And I do it around this time of year. And Psychology Today, the magazine, addressed this. And they say one of the reasons that if you have income and you have money, it's never enough and it doesn't bring you happiness because you always want more. And they suggest just this, a fast, so that you bring yourself back to the days when you might have been scrounging. And if some people are already doing this, obviously, you know, you don't need to do this. But back to the days when you might have been getting quarters in the couch, and it makes you feel better. Is that what you're getting at?
That's exactly right. You absolutely described it. It's to jumpstart that thing in you that you want to do better with your money. And what better time to do it than now as the new year is beginning? So, you know, it's a quick way to sort of slap yourself and say, look, I got to stop all this unnecessary spending. I need to save more. I need to save for my retirement. I've got kids. I want to send them to college without having to have them take on debt. And this is what the financial fast is doing. 21 days, because they say it takes about that long for something to stick with you.
Right.
And so that's why it's that long.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, they were pointing out in Psychology Today, it's you know, good if you change your financial ways, but it's also about when you go back, you appreciate what you have and you don't need to up the ante again. And for you, there's also a spiritual component to this.
Absolutely. The fast came out of a ministry that I run at my church in Maryland, First Baptist Church of Glenwood. Got to get a shout out to them. And essentially what it was is that so many people were coming up to me, how can you help me personally? And I thought, let's do this thing. Because I was doing the Daniel fast at the time where you fast from food. And I thought, why don't I apply the same principles to your money?
I have to jump in.
Shut everything down.
I have to
Go
jump
ahead.
In the Daniel fast.
Right. That's a spiritual fast in which you don't eat any meat or sugar and sodas, and you cut out all the impurities. You just eat fresh fruits and vegetables, and it's a way to cleanse your system.
Mm-hmm.
The financial fast has a similar principle. Shut down all that shopping, and you can't use plastic. No credit. I'll tell you, it sounds a lot easier when people think, oh, I could do that, but just think about all the unconscious spending that you do. And listen, this fast is not not just for people who are financially challenged, as I call them. If you're good with your money, it's a way for you to sort of reassess, are you on the same road that you put yourself in at the beginning when you started saving?
Yeah. So no credit cards, nothing that you don't need. And when does this start?
Well, I'm going to do a nationwide fast on starting January the 13th, Monday, January 13th. So I figured I'd give you a week after, you know, New Year's to get settled. And I'm asking people all across the country to join me on this fast. And you can email me at colorofmoney@washpost.com. Go to me to the Washington Post, michellesingletary.com. Sign up. And I'm telling you already, we've got, you know, dozens and dozens of people ready to take this challenge to go into the new year with a different aspect about their money.
Okie doke. We'll link people up at hereandnow.org so they can join you. Michelle Singletary, personal finance columnist for The Washington Post. Thank you, and Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too, and I hope you join me on the fast.
I will. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
And if you're on a charity's mailing list, you're probably hearing from them because today's the last day this year to give and get a tax deduction. But increasingly, donors are not giving directly to charities. They're giving to asset management firms like Fidelity. Fidelity Charitable is the philanthropic arm of Fidelity. It's the second biggest charity in the country, United Way is number one. Donors give to Fidelity, get their tax break, and then Fidelity or Schwab and Vanguard hold the money in special accounts, collect management fees, and keep the money from charities for a while. At least that's what critics say. Fidelity says it grows the money and ultimately gives out more than other foundations. Stacey Palmer is editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy. So, Stacey, where do you stand? These donor-advised funds, what are they?
These funds are growing incredibly fast, and they're really just like charity checking accounts. Let's say I have $10,000 that I want to give away, but I'm not really sure where I want to give it to. So I plunk the money into the account. I take my tax deduction for my $10,000, and it sits there, and it can grow, or I can decide to give it away, and I get to recommend what charities I want to give to over the year, over the next 5 years, over the next 10 years. And I can put more money in anytime I want and get a tax deduction.
Yeah. And these donor-advised funds were just a blip until the 1990s when Fidelity introduced this charitable gift fund. Other firms, as we said, are now doing it. How big do you think this category is?
It's very big. We know that at least $45 billion in assets are held now, and they keep growing. Some of the nonprofits that raise money this way, Schwab, Fidelity, they're increasing by as much as 90% in some years, and that's phenomenal in these hard-pressed times. Most charities are struggling to raise 2 or 3% more than they did the year before. So these increases show just how powerful these funds have become.
Well, and what is the concern? Because, as we said, Fidelity says that it will grow the money. Ultimately, there might be more money to give out. But you have people like Boston College law professor Ray Madoff, who says this money could otherwise go directly to a working charity, charities that desperately need it. What's the truth here?
One of the things that bothers the critics is there's no requirement that you give money away from your fund. You really could keep it in until you die, and the money then would go to charity. Now, funds like Fidelity put a rule in so that every 7 years you have to give some money away. And it's a minimal amount, just $250. But they still say that you do have to at least disperse something. And the fact that there's no requirement is part of what really bothers the critics. The other part is that these funds aren't transparent. When you're something like the Gates Foundation or the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, you file an informational tax form that anybody can see, that the IRS can check up on you. But if you're in a donor advised fund, that money is locked up. It's private, and it's great if you're a donor who wants to stay anonymous, but it's not so good if you're a charity trying to get that money.
Well, let's take this one step at a time. Who would that benefit to have no payout? I mean, certainly not the donor, because once they give the money, it's not theirs. That doesn't benefit the donor, right?
It doesn't, but some people just don't know where they want to give and aren't really thinking about it. You're right. There's no incentive for the donor to hold on to it, but it's one of those out of sight, out of mind things, and especially in this bad economy when many nonprofits need money right now to be able to pay their bills. It is upsetting people that some of this money is just staying in these funds for years and years.
Other critics say there is some incentive for the banks. Managers have to be paid to manage this money. The longer it stays at Fidelity, the more money they make off it.
Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons that the funds don't really have a huge incentive to tell you to take it out. Now, they know for public policy reasons they need to talk about helping you give. And Fidelity's really stepped up over the years some of the advice it gives to donors so that they will give the money away. But certainly they have a financial incentive to keep the money growing. And there have been some concerns that that's what's happening at other funds around the country. One thing that's important to realize, it's the donor's decision about how much to give. And you might have a really good reason for not wanting to give the money away in the first year. It might be that you know that the group you support is about to start a capital campaign and you want to start accumulating that money now and letting it grow. And 3 years from now, you'll make a commitment to that capital campaign for a building or a research project or something you really care about.
Well, what does Fidelity say?
Fidelity says that, you know, it is encouraging people to give money away and that it does have this rule that every 7 years you have to give some money away. And if you don't give that money away, it reverts into Fidelity's charitable coffers. So it will give the money away for you. So that's a pretty powerful incentive. So they do take some steps to deal with this. They also point out that at least 17% of the money is given out every year. And that's a lot more than private foundations are giving away. Private foundations are required to give at least 5% of their assets every year. So that's a foundation like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. That's all they're required to give. So 17% is a whole lot more than that 5% requirement.
So we want to underscore that. The Fidelity points out that it does, or it claims that it gives out more money than it might be required to. But again, we mentioned Boston College law professor Ray Madoff. She's calling for some sort of regulation. What is the sense there?
A lot of the critics would like donors to be required to give this money away. The feeling is that you're getting a tax benefit immediately, so why shouldn't you be expected to give the money away so that it benefits society right away? And because the assets are growing so fast, at some point Congress probably will pay attention to it, and there would be some kind of a federal requirement. Probably it would be that 5% requirement, just like the foundations are required to do. I would never expect them to do much more than that.
Yeah. Well, meanwhile, your organization, again, the Chronicle of Philanthropy, writes about what else is going on here, a new culture clash or cultural divide, if you will, a stark difference in the fundraising results of United Way, which helps the needy by distributing to social service groups and raises its money from mostly middle class, maybe blue collar people, and Fidelity, which is, you know, become a charity for the more affluent.
Yes, we've seen a real change in the way people give, and United Way is not as popular as it used to be. It's one of the oldest charities in the country, but many people don't like the way it decides to give money away and the fact that it makes the decisions. They'd rather make the decisions themselves. So something like Fidelity is appealing to people, and particularly to people who already have financial investments at a place like Fidelity. So many of its customers are the people who put the money away, and those tend to be more affluent people. You know, United Way is struggling for lots of reasons, in part because people are just frustrated with the way it solicits money. So part of it is a blue-collar, white-collar thing, but some of it is about the way United Way itself operates. And a lot of the old-fashioned charities are struggling to gain market share these days. People are looking for new ways to give money and thinking about things in different ways.
Stacey Palmer, editor of the Chronicle of Philanthropy, with some things for people to chew over on this, the last day of the year, the last day in which some people make their charitable donations. Stacey, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
And we can't say enough. Today's the last day. Think of a group that you love. It's the last day to make that charitable donation for 2013. And by the way, we hear from Australia, Japan, China. 2014 is going swimmingly. You're listening to Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
It's Here and Now, and it's one of rock and roll's most iconic anthems. Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run. His next album, High Hopes, comes out next month, but fans are still buzzing about this first big hit. And the early draft of Born to Run lyrics that sold for $197,000 at auction at Sotheby's earlier this month, a commanding price for the scribblings of a struggling young musician nearly four decades ago. It made us wonder, how and why did Springsteen write what ended up becoming one of the greatest rock songs of all time? Peter Ames Carlin wrote the 2012 Springsteen biography, Bruce, with the cooperation of The Boss. He joins us now. Peter, welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
Tell us, first of all, about this. It was a notebook, actually, that sold. Tell us more about it.
Well, Bruce has always, or for many, many, many years, going back to the earliest part of his career, kept notebooks full of songs and ideas and random words and stray thoughts. And out of these occasionally cryptic remarks, he would create his songs. And so if you look through the books that he kept in those, you know, over the course of that album, you'll find a lot of very sort of stripped down, you know, completely raw iterations of those songs that became such cultural epics.
Yeah. Start with the chorus. We got to get out while we're young. What do the scribblings show us about what he was writing?
The one thing that's there, present throughout the entire, you know, all the different iterations of the song, is the phrase, take my hand because tramps like us, baby, we were born to run. But so many other things are, you know, completely raw or in totally different form. I mean, the first line is something like, the junkies at the palace shotgunned some soldiers who were up from Fort Dix. But even in that line, you've got a couple scribble-ins or things written near it. The words hit angel around the junkies part. But it's hard to tell whether those are just phrases he scribbled in randomly, you know, not meant for that particular lyric, or whether he was considering placing them in the verse somewhere.
Where was Springsteen when he was writing this song? What, 1974, 5? Where was he in his career and in his life?
He was living then. He had just broken up with a longtime girlfriend, and he was living in a little bungalow he had just rented north of Asbury Park on the Jersey Shore. And he describes sitting on his bed in the little bedroom and suddenly having that phrase pop into his head. From there, the thing grew. You know, I think something resonated with him. I think just the phrase, born to run, is really kind of the key phrase that launches the entire album, ultimately.
Yeah.
You know, to get out of town, to get out of where you are, and to recreate yourself.
Well, stay with the recreate yourself part, because the book was in the possession of his former manager. And we remember in the early years, Bruce Springsteen had a huge blow up with the manager and record contract disputes. He was actually taken out of play for a while because of it. Where was he professionally? Was there a part of that, too, a pressure from the record companies to get some terrific thing down on paper?
Oh, absolutely. At that time, he had put out two records, neither of which had been particularly successful, and particularly given the amount of buzz he had when he came into the company in 1972. You know, they thought this guy was really it.
He was the future of rock and roll.
Well, that was before anyone called him the future of rock and roll, but that was essentially what they thought. And but then the albums just never really connected, the first two. And by the start of 1974, it was clear that you know, there was a new president at the label. There was a lot of new leaders at the thing, and they didn't have the kind of emotional connection that the earlier generation of people did. They basically said, "Well, we'll give you enough money to make a single, and if you can make a single that sounds commercial to us, then you can make the rest of the album. But if we don't like the single, we're basically dropping you from the label."
Yeah.
And so he went into this process, you know, the Born to Run album, knowing full well that in, you know, practically a literal way, his life was at stake.
Putting it all in. Well, what's interesting, we're going to talk more about Born to Run as we deconstruct that song. But a year earlier, in 1973, he'd written Blinded by the Light. It was on Greetings from Asbury Park, but it failed commercially and turned out to be a hit for Manfred Mann's band, 1976. But it's very different, very complicated. Let's listen to some of those lyrics.
Madman, drummers, bombers, and Indians in the summer with a teenage diplomat. In the dumps with the mumps as the adolescent pumps his way into his hat.
It's obvious he sort of said, okay, that was maybe too complicated. I'm just going to go with a story, Born to Run.
Yeah, well, you know, his manager, you know, the guy we were talking about a second ago, Mike Appel, I mean, that was kind of their mantra going into this album. He was always yelling to Bruce, you know, simplify, simplify, simplify. And eventually, you know, one of Bruce's greatest strengths, I think, as a writer is his ability to capture the essence of very complicated feelings and ideas in one or two lines.
Well, he also musically stripped away early things that he'd attached to the song. You can find him on YouTube. Here is a woman's chorus, some extra singing and instrumentation that ended up being cut out. Oh, dear.
Yeah. Well, it didn't work, obviously. You know, they worked on that tune for like 6 months, putting things on, taking things off, completely revising the song, going back to earlier versions. I mean, it was, you know, just the work was constant.
Well, let's listen to another version that was dropped. Oh, no. You know, when you hear that, it's lovely in a way, as the women's chorus was sort of in a Phil Spector girl group way.
Yeah.
But it wouldn't have been the same rough and tumble song. What's great about the song to you?
You know, it's just got this incredible power to it. It's that feeling of his emotions just exploding out of the song. And that song is kind of just a 4.5 minute catharsis, basically. And the fact that he sings, you know, every syllable like his life depended on it. And it became a mission statement for the whole rest of his career, in a sense. I mean, obviously he's evolved quite a bit, but that burning feeling of being young and having no place to go and feeling walled off from the opportunities in life, you know, I mean, and what that song's about, just like what Thunder Road's about, is saying, well, screw it, you know, I'm going to jump in the car and head off down the highway and I ain't going to stop until, you know, we'll get to that place that we really want to go and we'll walk in the sun. And on the one hand, that line, the place where we really want to go, seems kind of lame, you know, on the page. It's like, well, what place, dude? Tell me, you know, where exactly are we headed? But on the other hand, in the context of the song and sort of swept up in the tornado of feeling in that song, it makes perfect sense. It's like he has no idea where he's headed, but it doesn't matter as much as at least starting the journey, you know, leaping into the void just on the strength of your own belief in yourself.
That's Peter Ames Carlin. He wrote the 2012 Bruce Springsteen biography. Bruce, we're talking about the song Born to Run. Some early scribblings of lyrics just sold for $197,000 at Sotheby's. Peter, thanks so much for helping us look at this one song.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you.
Something more to be grateful for. No strings in Born to Run. So from Jeremy Hobson and the hardworking staff of Here and Now, thank you for being here in 2013. Come with us as we see what 2014 brings. From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the Institute of Contemporary Art with Amy Sillman, One Lump or Two. Vivid abstract paintings and drawings closes January 5th, ICABoston.org.